Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward.
Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And one of the great things that we love to talk about here on the show is how everyone can basically go on one creative path and then all of a sudden pivot and create something else. And one of the perfect examples of that is the actress Annie Corzin. Because Annie is not only an actress, you've also seen her as Doris Klum on Seinfeld. But she has also done so much writing, so much performing of her own work, and so much speaking on the various circuits, all the way to reaching a very interesting milestone as she has reached over 500,000 subscribers on TikTok. And she has basically become an accidental influencer. And that has led her to create her own book, which is out now. There is a whole lot of ground to cover with Annie and the pivot that she has taken to moving into this new wonderful era of social media. And it is my pleasure to introduce my guest this week, Annie Corzin. Annie, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? And I congratulate you. You pronounced everything correctly.
My name. Thank you so much.
Chutzpah. Not everybody does. Oh my goodness. Okay. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not the first Jewish woman you've ever met.
Oh, no. Far from it. I also have to mention that I was born in New York City and spent 17 years in that area when I went to college. So, yeah, there's no all friends here. So I am just thrilled to have you here. And I'm really excited to hear about not only about your history in creativity, because you've gone in so many different directions, but also the direction that you've gone in now, as you have basically embraced social media and created something that you've been able to take and run with.
Well, I don't know if I embrace it or it embraced me, because I still don't understand it. I really don't. I don't use it. I don't understand Instagram. I don't use Twitter. And even TikTok, I don't actually use it. I'm there as a performer. So when it comes to social media, I'm really an amateur. But before we talk about it, I want to go back to something that you mentioned about people who do more than one thing. Years ago, I was a struggling actress and not doing very well. And I remember the therapist said, it is a known fact that anybody who's creative in one area is always creative in at least one other area. And I think people tend to kind of limit themselves by thinking, oh, I could. I was brought up to be a musician. I was a piano teacher when I got married. I was always in love with theater and music, and films, but I was a musician, not a very brilliant one, and I didn't love it, but that was my first profession. So I went from there to acting, and I went from acting to writing, and I went from writing to just creating and producing my own solo shows. And I went from that to storytelling. And by the way, teaching storytelling. I've been with The Moth. I don't know if you're familiar with The Moth, the storytelling organization. As a result of all those years of storytelling, I had a young friend, 30. I'm 86. She's 30. She said, you ought to be on. Oh, I said, I'm doing my shows. I'm doing my storytelling. The audiences are so small, so limited. I wish I could find a larger audience. And she said, well, you should go on TikTok. And I said, TikTok, you got to be crazy. Why? Who would want to see this old lady? And she said, trust me, you will go viral. One of the themes of my book, George, is always say yes to things, because you don't know what anything's going to. I don't regret anything I've ever done. I've only regretted the things that I didn't do. So I have a mantra, and my mantra is, yeah, why not? And I said to her, I think this is the craziest idea I ever heard, but yeah, why not? And we posted our first post 1 week before lockdown in March 2020.
Wow.
Talk about timing.
Yeah, really. Well, it was fortunate timing because it was a good time to be on TikTok because people had nothing else to do. They were home.
And were yearning for connection as well.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so, as she guaranteed, I went viral very quickly. And it's still a mystery to me. And what's also a mystery to me is that a lot of my fans are very young. They're Gen Zers. The people who stop me on the street, which I love because I love attention, being a performer. The fans who book me to send a cameo. Do you know what cameo is?
Oh, yeah.
Well, the people I do cameo are mostly people in their 20s. So there's a huge age gap between me and many of my followers. And I appreciate that because they've done things for me that people my own age they appreciate me in a way that I never did feel appreciated by my peers.
Hmm. And at the same time, what you had mentioned before about being creative in one field and being creative in more than one field, by that time you had already conquered that, really, because you had not only performed on stage, but you also wrote your own shows.
Yes, yes. I had, and I wrote magazine articles. I did whatever I could do. But whatever I did, I never felt I was reached. I really felt I'm arrogant enough to feel that I have something worth saying, that I have something to say, that I have something inspiring, that I have something reassuring, or I have acquired in my many years, I've acquired some life wisdom that I think has some value. But I could never find the right audience for it. And the last thing I ever expected is that would be a TikTok audience. And then as a result of my getting that large audience on TikTok, I was then able to make a book deal. That's how I sold the book. Book is simply a collection of the kinds of humorous stories and humorous advice and humorous insights that I do on TikTok.
Mm-hmm. And
it's expanded.
Oh, of course. And it sounds like a lot of what you were saying is similar to what another Seinfeld co-star had mentioned recently. I'm not sure if it's recently, but in the past few years, I've seen this clip go viral. And it's of Jason Alexander saying that the times have passed when it comes to people waiting by the phone for their opportunities. It's time for them to make your opportunities.
That's very interesting. I know Jason quite.
And you're living proof of that. And you're living proof of that.
But Jason is terrific, and he's very smart. And not only did I do Seinfeld with him, but he asked me to play his sister in a theatrical production of Neil Simon's, what is it, Second Avenue? Oh, my gosh. I forgot. Prisoner of Second Avenue.
Oh,
he was terrific in that. So we did spend some time together. But Jason, I would say, I'm going to have to say more than most actors, is a thoughtful person. He's a thinker. You know what I mean? I don't know if you could say that about every actor in the world, and they don't have to be.
Right.
But that's funny that he said that. I have never believed that anyone's going to give me anything because they never have. I've spent my life banging on doors. And that's part of, you can't just be creative and think that work is going to fall into your lap.
Right.
You know, John Waters, John Waters, the film director.
Oh, yeah.
John Waters. Mm-hmm. He says, the way he puts his life is like this. He says, I spend the first 4 hours of every day writing. And I spend the rest of the day trying to turn my writing into money. And that's really the life of an art. That's what you have to do. Most of what I've gotten on my own by banging on doors, by making connections, by meeting and greeting and blah, blah, blah. Now, some of it I enjoy because I like meeting people. I don't mind that. But that's your job as an artist. And artists have always done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not enough to create the best possible things.
Like
if you're performing them in front of an empty theater, then
it doesn't
even happen.
Yeah. It doesn't mean anything.
It didn't even happen. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, you do have to keep doing your thing. And also, there's all kinds of, how shall I say it? There's ways to learn. When I started TikTok, it had to be under a minute. The TikToks had to be under a minute.
Right,
my storytelling experience, my stories, like the stories that you'll read in my book, The Book of Annie, Hubert Hart and Hudson Furman, accidentally, which you can get on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. My stories as a storyteller usually went like between 8 and 12 minutes long. So I had to take some of those ideas and think, how can I say this in under 60 seconds? So that was a new challenge.
And now that kind of forces you to basically just kind of be creative when you have those sort of restrictions.
Yeah, that's a challenge. Beautiful thing.
Whether it's time or money or whatever.
Absolutely. And then the other thing, when I say that my theme is, yeah, why not? Let me tell you my Seinfeld story. I was in LA. I was a New York actress. I got crap jobs. I did movie extras. I did children's theater. Nothing at all very significant. We moved to LA and I thought what I really wanted to do was be on a sitcom. I'm a comedy person. I wanted to get TV work. What I got were very, very small bit roles. And my agent called one day and he said, listen, there's this new show. They want somebody for a couple of lines. And it turned out that a better known actress in my agency's office turned down the audition because she felt the part wasn't large enough. She had never heard of the show and the part wasn't big enough for her. And I went into why not? I'll go in an audition, which meant I had to take my life in my hands because I'm the world's worst driver, being a New Yorker, I never drove. And I had to get to the Valley. I ended up on a 7-lane freeway where I had to cross all the lanes to get. I risked my life to get that audition, to do that audition. And they hired me and I did it. It was just a couple of lines. And when my husband, Benny, when we watched that episode, this is back in 91. My first episode was a classic episode called The Pen. Mm-hmm. It's one of the iconic Seinfeld episodes. It takes place down in Florida at his parents' condo. I'm one of the parents' neighbors. And my husband watched it and he said, I don't get this. It's not about anything. Now he never goes to bed without watching at least two or three episodes. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. They liked me. It was a bit part. And they asked me back. So I went back. And that little bit part turned into a recurring role of Doris Pompous on side. And then they still liked me. And so they had me come in and do a second character. I'm an obnoxious airline passenger sitting next to Elaine when Elaine is stuck in coach and Jerry's been upgraded. It's another classic episode.
Yep.
Now, I want to tell you something, George. Since and all those shows, the total of my lines adds up to, I once counted them, something like 28 lines on all four or five episodes that I did. Since 1991, my residuals for Seinfeld have come to about $100,000.
Wow.
And I'm still getting them. I still get checks all the time because the show, it sells here, it sells there, it shows here. Mm-hmm. And so I think about the woman who said, I'm not going to do this audition because there's not enough. I don't know the show, there's not enough. And I think of me who said, yeah, why not? You never know. And I have to tell you also for me personally, even more than the money. Well, I shouldn't say that. The money was greatly appreciated.
Of course.
My career changed because people would look at me, oh, you were a regular on Seinfeld? Now they say, come here. So that I rose to another level professionally. I got more respect. I got more requests for auditions. It even helped my writing. One thing feeds another thing. When I started writing articles, I sent an article to the New York Times. Ooh. And in my pitch, I said, hi, I've written this article for the blah, blah. I think you might. And by the way, you might want to know, I was Doris Pompous on Seinfeld. And they bought it immediately. And the first thing the editor said was, yes, I'd like to work with you. We will take this article. By the way, what was it like to work with Jerry?
That's great.
So in other words, just that connection turned out to be a magical thing only because somebody else thought it was beneath her. I don't think anything is beneath me.
And this kind of reminds me of something that one of my fellow author friends once said, Nicole Evelina. She said, never count your no's because all it takes is one yes. And in this case, it sounds like you were giving the yes to yourself. In a sense, you were saying, yeah, why not? I'll make that audition. I'll make that happen.
And absolutely. Sure enough, that's what absolutely. Yeah. I had another ambition in my life. I wanted to be on The Moth. For those of you who are not familiar with The Moth is the most important global storytelling organization. They do radio shows. They do live shows. They're all over the world. Mm-hmm. And for a storyteller to do one of their mainstay, as a matter of fact, I think I did one in St. Louis, come to think of it.
No kidding.
In a beautiful old theater. What's your beautiful old theater there?
The Fabulous Fox. There's the Fabulous Fox Theater. There's
Powerball. Gorgeous, gorgeous theater.
Oh, very nice.
Anyway, so to be a storyteller, to do main stage with The Moth is a big deal. You can also hear me, by the way, you can go to themoth.org and hear one of my stories there. Anyway, my big ambition as a storyteller was to be with The Moth main stage. Mm. Yeah. And I had a contact, I had an introduction. And whenever I performed, I would send them a video. Hi, it's Annie Corzin. Here's another story I did. And they would say, thank you. Keep submitting. We'll let you know. Thank you. Keep submitting. We'll let you know. Mm-hmm. George, I did this for 9 years.
Wow.
9 years of not getting. And every time I did a story, I would, hi, it's Annie. Okay. And finally, one day, I gave up. I said to my husband, you know something? I can't do this anymore. I want this so badly. And I know in my heart I belong there. Yeah. But for some reason, they're not seeing it. And I had sent in something, and I didn't hear from them. And I said to Betty, I can't do this anymore. It's too painful. I think 9 years is enough. And I swear to God, the next day, I got a call from New York. Hi, Annie. This is Catherine at The Moth. She was the head of the whole thing. Thank you for being so patient. Says after 9 years.
Oh, it's great.
We have some shows coming up. I'd like you to do Berkeley, LA, St. Louis, and the Schubert Theater in Boston.
Wow.
And that's how I now I'm working with them on a second story. And now they all love me and I know them. But I knew I belonged there. I knew I belonged there. And I would keep, and people forget you. I kept reminding and reminding. And it turned out that when they finally took me, it was because Catherine was pregnant and she had been in the hospital. She'd been waiting. She had been not allowed to go to the office for a couple of weeks. She sat down and decided to go through all the old emails that she hadn't responded to and all the old material that people had sent her. She took a week or two to do that. And there I was. Isn't that amazing?
That is wonderful. And that's a wonderful just example of being persistent, not giving up, being true to yourself and pushing forward.
I believe that. I do believe that.
Yeah. And now, just like what you're saying, how part of what you're doing, part of what you always did was just kind of knocking on doors and reminding people of who you are. And in a sense, now with TikTok, it's almost like it's doing the work for you. It's knocking on everyone else's cell phones.
This is true. It's been very helpful. It's been even I was in a movie. What was it called? A Moving On with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. Mm. And it's a director I greatly admire because he co-directed one of my favorite movies about a boy. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's a British movie with Hugh Grant.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's a lovely, it's a wonderful movie.
Yeah.
And so at one point, and I was doing my usual four lines, but it was four lines with Jane Fonda. So that was exciting. But we rehearsed the scene and then he took me aside to give me notes. And I thought to give me notes, right? That's what directors do. No, he said, Annie, I just have to tell you how much I love that story about your grandson on TikTok. And I almost fainted that away. Maybe that's why he hired. I'm sure it's why he hired me. Mm-hmm. Because when he looked at all the taped auditions and he saw me, he said, wait a minute, I know this woman from TikTok. I think he has that great story. Anyway, but you said something before. Oh, you're very provocative to talk to, and I like that. Because you say things that make me think of things. It's more than believing in yourself, and it's more than just giving up. You also have to work on yourself. Oh, and by the way, at one point when I said to somebody at the Moth, why did it take you 9 years to book me? And she said, well, you got better. And this is true. I wasn't the same person 9 years as I was the beginning 2 or 3 or 4 years. these things, it takes a while to get good at what you do.
Do you think the fact that it took 9 years was almost like kind of putting a chip on your shoulder and just like, I'll show them. Do you think that may have had something to do with it?
I don't know if that was it. I just didn't feel I had a choice. I knew this was something I had to do. But what I want to tell you is, it's more than just believing in yourself. You have to work on yourself. You have to learn from other people, whether that means taking a class or joining a writing group or reading. Mm-hmm. I just had a very sad experience with someone I know who's talented in many ways, but never kind of sticks with anything. She decided she's done photography, she's done branding, she's done interior design. Now it's time for her to write her memoirs. So she wrote a 345-page memoir and gave it to me to look at. And I said, well, I think there are some things here, but I would suggest you read this. She said, no, I can't do that. I'm me, I'm my voice. In other words, she was saying she was not going to read other books. She was not going to maybe hire someone to show her how to edit. And that's not, if you feel you know it all and you don't need any help, that ain't going to work.
And
artists go to museums and look at other art. Writers read other writers. I belong to several writing groups. When I'm acting, I have someone, if it's something challenging, I have someone I go to for coaching. Can't do it on you. You can't do this all on your own and think you're going to be disappointed.
I definitely agree with you because when I was back in 2008, I wrote the first draft of one of my novels, and I was so confident that all I needed to do was touch it up here and there, and that I could start shopping it around because it has universal appeal and all of that. And then I handed it over to a friend of mine that I worked with. And she read the first chapter and said, wow, this is going to take a lot of work. And we worked for almost 2 years getting it right. And even then, when it was released, when I decided to self-publish it, just because of my own, I guess you would say, insecurities about myself and just wanting to hold on to those characters because I had more ideas for them. And I knew that if they were to get latched onto a publisher and it didn't do well, then they would keep those character rights and I wouldn't be able to do anything with it. So I decided to self-publish it then.
Okay.
So I decided to self-publish it then. And even after that, when it found a small publisher and then when it found another small publisher years later, it was constantly evolving. And I had to keep on evolving it because all I wanted was for this story to be the best it could be.
Right.
And that was all I cared about. And thankfully, the right people really took a sledgehammer to a lot of my work and required me to kind of
But you were open to that.
Yeah. But I needed that. Yeah.
Writing is one thing. I say, now I teach writing, not the kind that you do. I'm very bad. I mean, I couldn't teach fiction. And also, your medium is sci-fi or something.
Is it science fiction, young adult? Yeah.
I'm so wrong for that. If you came to me, I wouldn't take your money. But what I teach is what I do. I teach the humorous essay, creating, performing the humorous essay. It's a short form thing. That's what I'm good at. And I have found time and time and time again, the material that people give me, there's some talent there. They can write. What they cannot do is edit. And that's one of the most important parts of being a writer. You've got to know how to edit, what to take out. And that's true in a lot of things. Look, don't you feel lately when you go to the movies, every movie is 20 minutes too long?
Yeah, I would say so.
You don't want to lose that moment. And so even if his editor says, you know, we should lose it, the directors don't like to let go of their material because directors are not writers.
And quite a few of them just need to just kind of get refreshers from some of the classic screenplays. Just as a little reminder that the best kinds of stories are the ones that either introduce a new problem or expand on an old problem with every single scene. So that way nothing is you're not missing anything. All that space is being properly used. I always say network is one of the greatest of all time.
Oh my God. Oh, that's so, I can't believe I'm getting chills that you mentioned network.
Really?
I'm going to tell you about Network. I have a friend, Alan Heim, who edited Network. He won an Oscar for All That Jazz, but he edited Network. I have another friend who is the son of Beatrice Strait. In Network, Beatrice Strait plays the wife of William Holden. Now,
who won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar for that? For one scene.
But I'm going to tell you how she won it. The director, and here we go again, director Sidney Lumet came to my friend Alan and said, I've decided we have to lose that scene with Beatrice. It's not working. It's out. And Alan said, hold on a minute. Before you decide to cut it, I think it can work. It's just in the wrong place. Let me noodle with it. Let me fool around. Let me see if I can find where that scenes work. I really don't want to lose it. And Sidney said, okay, see what you could do with it. And Alan found another place for it, and Sidney accepted it, and Beatrice Strait won the Oscar.
And
for that scene. And I told this story at a party at my house where Tony Cook said, where Beatrice's son was. He's got that Oscar in his living room, his mother's passed on. And I introduced the two of them. Isn't that a great showbiz story?
That is wonderful. That is absolutely wonderful. And it's funny because I'm pretty sure he was nominated for Network for Best Editing.
Could be, I don't know. He's been nominated more than once.
But like of all the movies that could have topped that, it wound up being Rocky. So you kind of had to give it to that for the editing. So I see.
Yeah. It's funny because he also that's an interesting story how Sylvester Stallone had nothing. He had no money, he had nothing. And he was offered, I forget how much money.
Oh, it was like in the six figures.
But somebody else would play it. And he turned that down. How do you turn down that? You got to admire somebody.
Yeah.
That's believing in yourself.
Absolutely. And that is what I always say, like the royal we, but it's really just me in my walk-in closet here. But that is something that I always want to celebrate in terms of those that take a chance on themselves and say exactly what you say. Right. Why not?
Well, I want to tell you something else, something that I learned on TikTok, and that is, it's another theme in my book. I have my whole life been told that I'm too opinionated, that I'm too talkative, that I'm too direct about voicing my thoughts. All my life, I've been criticized for that. I've been told it's not a feminine quality, that women shouldn't be that outspoken. And I've been told it's off-putting in general. And I've always apologized for it. Now, on TikTok, I am as frank and blunt and opinionated as I want. And I am being celebrated for it.
As well.
So the things that I apologize for all of my life, I'm now being celebrated for. And there's a second part to this. I've also been taught all my life in showbiz, I've been told that I'm ugly. They don't use that word. They say, you're a character actress. In other words, if there were a casting call tomorrow for an attractive older woman, I would never be seen for it. In Hollywood, an attractive older woman is Helen Mirren. I've always felt bad about that. I've always felt bad that I'm not attractive enough to play a doctor, a lawyer, somebody with authority, somebody with class. I play basically obnoxious characters on television. Now, again, on TikTok, these younger fans, guess what? They tell me I'm beautiful. They like my style. They like my, oh, your jewelry's so great. Or your outfit. Oh, what color lipstick is that? It looks so good. Oh, your hair looks great today. Never, ever in my life have I gotten compliments on how I look until now. Wow. And so the theme that I want to say that it's in the book is do not be imprisoned by other people's negative opinions of you. You're too this, you're too that, you're too loud. You cannot be imprisoned by other people's opinion, negative opinions of you. And we all do it, don't we?
And especially us creatives. Please, please let me entertain you and please love me for doing that for you.
Right. Yeah. And let me be honestly who I am. It's not such a bad thing. If you're not harming anybody, if you're not hurting anybody, and you have certain quirks that people constantly criticize you for, maybe you should own those quirks. Maybe you should celebrate them. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And that's something that a lot of people really need to know. So I'm so glad that this is not only have you said that here, but you've also said that in your book. So
yes, I want people to know that. And again, as I say, I feel that I have things to say to people that maybe can inspire them or maybe can help them. No. So my subjects are, I don't talk religion. I don't talk politics. I don't I want to create a place that's free of ugliness, which is impossible to do. It still rears its head once in a while. Yeah. But I talk about things that I think are important, like marriage and dating and motherhood and career. But I also talk about, and I didn't know, about being honestly who you are. Now, I was brought up poor. My parents were immigrants. I was brought up in a 3-room railroad flat in the Bronx. I mean, we had enough to eat, but we never had any extras. No extras, right?
Yeah.
And I knew, and I don't know if I knew that we were poor. I think I kind of did know that we were poor. So I grew up knowing not to waste anything. I don't waste anything. I don't waste money. I don't waste food. I was brought up with this instinct for being thrifty, for saving money. And it's been a lifestyle of mine, and I've turned it into something valuable. You can see behind me, my home is full of antiques. It's full of art. It's full of valuable things, which I have acquired for nickels and dimes, because I never shop retail. I spend my life in thrift stores and yard sales and estate sales and online. So that's always been a part of my life. And I thought that, well, that's just me because of the way I grew up. Well, I discovered on TikTok that thrifting is a new thing. It's a new trend that people don't want to spoil the planet with fast fashion. They don't want to spoil the, every time you buy something, you're reusing something that someone else owned. You're doing something for the planet, and you're doing something for your pocketbook. But I didn't know that this was a new trend. I thought it was just me that did it. And then I started talking about it. People said, oh, wow, tell us more. So again, I was just being me.
Yeah.
I had no idea that this was a big thing out there, that thrifting was a big movement now.
It's pretty incredible how all it takes is just to, like you said, live your honest self and be who you are, and just don't. It's amazing what happens when you can just kind of take down any sort of protective shield that you've been building up on yourself, and you can just allow yourself to be vulnerable and out there. Just kind of allow your voice to just be natural.
Absolutely. And also, I think when it comes to materialism, I think we in America, we've got to think about this a little bit. I'll give you an example. I would never, ever be seen in public with something that had a label on it. Mm. With something that said across Chanel, Balenciaga, whatever. Because I don't want to do unpaid advertising. And I don't want to show, it doesn't interest me that somebody knows that I spent a lot of money for something. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That kind of materialism doesn't interest me. So whenever I see somebody with their Louis Vuitton luggage or with their Chanel bag or with, I kind of, how shall I say it without sounding too, I kind of look down on them. Hmm. I kind of disapprove of that kind of spending. Spending thousands and thousands. Somebody in LA a couple of months ago, or maybe it was a year ago, was held up in a Beverly Hills restaurant of his, what's it called, those watches, Philippe Patek watch. And the watch was worth $300,000. He was held up at gunpoint. I did not feel sorry for him. I did not. If I had an extra $300,000, I would not spend it on a watch.
Yeah, definitely not just something you could put on a wrist. Definitely not something that you would just put on a wrist and just look at that and be like, wow, look where all that money went.
That kind of extra money lying around, I might think of how I might use it to make the world a better place. You know, I contribute to certain social activists, organizations that I want to support, or Meals on Wheels for old people who don't have money. We have people in this country who don't have enough money to eat. Why would you spend three? To me, it's offensive. I don't, again, it's my background of respecting money and respect. And I just, it's not, I don't aspire to that. I mean, I like nice things and I love to shop. That's why I do. But yeah. I don't need a $300,000 watch to gain respect.
That's a great way to look at it. Yeah.
The pressure of what we spend money on, the pressure that these kids feel, you got to have a certain kind of sneaker, otherwise you're worthless. That kind of peer pressure to have the right shoe, to have the right, that's dangerous stuff. We have to really be aware of that.
Yeah, it just gets builds up more and more and more, and it just gets out of hand so easily.
Yeah.
So with all of this, with the book, you're getting everything that you got in this and sharing like a lot of really good lessons. Would this be part of that you would basically just kind of put in there, just kind of remind people that
I talk about money and to go in? I think also what it is we have to remind ourselves, we all want to be happy. What makes us happy?
Yeah.
And it's really not a $300,000 watch. I mean, the fact is that they've done studies and they say what makes people happiest is being surrounded by people they love and who love them. Now, not everybody has that.
Yeah.
Not everyone has access to that, and I don't want them to feel that they will never be happy. So I think that's kind of limiting. Maybe, and there are some people who like being alone. I have friends who like being alone with their dog. That's what makes them, they've discovered what it is they need in life. But I do think that interaction with our other humans is important. Some people need more of it than others. Yeah. And sometimes I've asked people who said, well, I am lonely, but I don't know how to find anybody. And I think there are things you can do in Scandinavia. My husband's Danish. In Scandinavia, everyone belongs to a club. There's a club this, there's a club for this. There's a music club. There's a book club. There's a political club. There's a gardening club. I think clubs are very important, and there are clubs for any interest. Clubs are a way to get to be part of a community. If you're lucky enough to be religious, obviously churches and temples and mosques and religious organizations are a way to feel that you're part of a community. Now, a lot of Jews belong to temple and they don't believe in God. They belong to temple, a lot. They go to temple because they want to feel that they're part of a community with similar moral beliefs, with similar ethnic background, that they're a part of a place where they will be accepted. And religion isn't always a necessary part of it.
True. It sounds a lot like
churches too. You go to church because you like the music and you like your neighbors and you want to feel part of a community.
Yeah. And you definitely feel a different sense of that, a more real sense of community when you're doing it in person.
Absolutely.
Because you can only do so much on social media and on Zoom. And like what we're doing right now is wonderful. But at the same time, how great would it be if we were just able to sit down, have a cup of coffee and talk about this sort of thing?
Absolutely. Or just you and I be talking in front of a live audience of 2,000 people.
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
I think a personal interaction, I think screens have, I know we need our screens, but I'll give you an example of something I like to do. I like talking to strangers because I'm always interested, because people always have stories. Say you're waiting online in the bank, in the supermarket, you're sitting next to someone on a plane, whatever, or in a doctor's office. Now you cannot approach anybody because their head is in their screen. So you can't really say, oh, hi, oh, those are great shoes. Where did you get them? You can't do that as easily as you used to. And I miss that. And I miss.
And after living in New York City for as long as I did, because I moved up there in 94, by that time I was there for all 4 years of college and stayed there in that area until 2011, when my wife and I made the journey back over here, because this is where she's from.
Okay.
But
New Yorkers talk to each other. New Yorkers,
yeah,
talk to each other also.
And not only, but I got so much reading done. I was so much calmer on my commute because I didn't have to deal with a car. It was just a great experience doing that.
I have a friend who was sitting on the subway in New York, and she saw a guy across the aisle from her. He was reading a book that she had just finished. So she went over to him. He said, "What do you think about it?" And they were married a year later. It happen if you're sitting in your car.
Right. Right.
Or if you're on your screen and don't see the world around you. Mm-hmm. No.
And I hope that those who are in the car and are listening to this conversation right now are inspired to look up, say, meetup.com and see what kind of groups, in-person groups, are in their area, because there are so many there. I hope that they take advantage of that, because it really is a special thing to be able to have a group in person and be able to.
Be I mean, able there, to are cooking, and network. There are yeah. cooking groups and sewing groups, and and of course, there are the recovery groups.
Yeah.
Those groups have done a lot of good in the world, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, there really is a lot of good in this world that can be overshadowed very easily. And
yes,
it's up to us creatives to really kind of point that out.
And I can barely watch the news anymore.
Oh, me neither.
Bad news sells. And so all you're going to get is bad news, because it's all about money. Everything's about money. And I want to hear good news. And there are good things going on in the world and in this country. We don't hear about them because they don't sell. But they exist. I had other friends. I had two friends who met because they were both in that Big Brother program where you take on a kid that needs another adult in their life.
Yeah.
And they met at the orientation meeting and they became a couple after. But to do something like that, to take on a relationship with a kid who needs somebody in their life, what a great thing to do.
It is.
What a great thing to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And they say, and I think it may be true, that when you do good things for other people, you feel better about your, when you create happiness for somebody else, it comes back at you. It makes you happier.
And not even to make that sound like selfish or anything like that, because I mean, it really is a wonderful thing. And there's nothing wrong with good about yourself when you're able to do something good for someone else.
Right.
So I think people need to embrace that.
I do too.
So the book itself, that you said that's available everywhere now, came out in 2023.
Well, it's on Amazon, both printed and audio. And I know that if a Barnes & Noble doesn't have it, they will order it for you. It's the Book of Annie, Humor, Heart, and Chutzpah from an Accidental Loser. I made one mistake, though, with the title. If you go and search the Book of Annie, what you'll get is the Book of Annie, the musical.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So sometimes it's better to search just with my name. It's Annie Corzin. If you look up Annie Corzin, it's easier. It's sometimes easier to find.
Oh,
titles. And I spent so much time trying to find the perfect title. I was so happy with this. It turns out it's problematic, but you can find it.
It still works. I love the accidental influencer part as well. I think that's terrific. So by all means, I hope that all of you who have been listening, please find Annie on TikTok. Be one of her followers. She's got.
Oh, by the way, on TikTok, I'm A. Corzin.
A.
Corzin. So it's K-O-R-Z-E-N is my last name. But I think actually if you search for Annie Corzin, you will find me. It'll come up.
Excellent.
And now I'm going to start YouTube.
Have the link in my show notes so that way people can go.
Oh, that would be great. If you have a link there and the link on Amazon, that would be
great. Absolutely. Yeah, there will be links where everyone can get their copies, their hands on this book, can subscribe to Annie on TikTok. Like Annie said, and like we've been discussing, sometimes you just got to say, yeah, why not? And open yourself up to the opportunities that are there. You never know what could be there. It could very likely be something that you never thought was even possible that you would be able to enter and master. And sure enough, there you are. So by all means, please keep plugging away. Keep getting yourself out there. The world needs you. The world needs your stories. And we need it now more than ever. So for Annie Corzin, this is George Leroy saying to all of you, ever upward. And I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@hesgotit.com.